Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Is my audio okay?
Very clear.
Yeah. Okay, great. So, Yom Vibhun, you'll be happy to know that we had two new fawns born into our deer population.
Okay.
And they were eating at my bird feeder this morning.
Usual place.
The usual place. But I gave them some buttered toast.
Okay.
And Tamavirio, you remember when we went to Mehong Son and we were going from at Chiang Mai Airport, and there was a fellow named, what was his name? Vera, I think. He was with me and Sister Xu Feng. And I went through the security and they found a knife in my yam. Remember that? Right?
Yes, come.
And you acted, or the guy called Vera acted very quickly and got some money and gave it to the security officer and said, can you post this? And I gave him Vera Dhammo Bhikkhu Watnanachat as the address, Ubon. So that was in December of 1918, correct? And so I never got it. So I thought, oh, didn't make it. So I guess the guy didn't post it. And I thought badly of the fellow. I thought he took your money. Well, 2-3 days ago, I got a letter from Wat Nanachat. And there was a package addressed to me that had been put away in a desk and forgotten about, not opened. So they wrote to me and said, should we send it? Should we look at it? I said, wow, it might be that knife. And sure enough, they opened it up and it's the knife. So it made it. But what it indicates, that kind of a story, is how perception can be inaccurate, right? So I misperceived this man as being dishonest, which wasn't very kind because I didn't know, but that my perception, and I don't even know who the fellow is. I can't even remember his face, but now my perception has changed to, well, he was an honorable fellow. That really worked well. And perception is something that is necessary. I know that this is a clock. I know that this is a Buddha image. I know where my robe is. These are perceptions which built up an ordinary world, which are necessary. But one of the things that Lompa Cha often reflected to us is that perception is unsure, isn't it? You're not quite sure, especially around people. But the most pernicious or most ignorant perception, I say ignorance in sense of avijja, is the perception that I am my thoughts, I am my emotions, I am this body. And that perception was what the Buddha was trying to help us look at and challenge. So the idea that I am not a good meditator, say, is a perception which would come if you had a quote-quote bad meditation. And so as Lumpa Sameda would say, we take it personally. I am someone who is not a good meditator. And that would come from some idea of what good meditation was, that you would feel tranquil, that your body wouldn't move, that you'd feel some bliss, and so on and so forth. And then that ideal would be contrasted to what a good meditation was, would be contrasted to what a bad meditation was. And so that would all create a sense of a world and a sense of a person. And so you might come out of the meditation feeling, I'm doing well, I'm not doing well. And then that would condition the next meditation and so on and so forth. And the challenge the Buddha gives us, he says, well, those perceptions that you that come up and create a sense of self are just thoughts dependent on previous activities. They're there, they're certainly there, but it's rather like my thoughts about the fellow insecurity at Chiang Mai Airport were conditioned by my expectation that the knife would make it to Wat Nanachat. It made it, I didn't know it, and I perceived him as being dishonest. Now I get other information, now I perceive him as honest, but I don't know the guy at all. I have no idea who he is. And that's perception, it's a necessary part. But the most difficult part is, of course, this self-perception that I am this body and that I am these emotions and so on and so forth. My emotions are a part of a story or a narrative. And the sense of personal history is part of a narrative. It exists. It does exist. So the narrative of Virodhammo is different than a narrative of Yom Pum or Yom Vibhun or whoever. These are different stories, different birth times and so on. But is that all we are? Are we just these storylines? Or is there some deeper spiritual possibility that we can realize this lifetime? And the Buddha says, yes, this is possible. And these are the ideas of the unconditioned or transcendence, which isn't a personal quality, which isn't masculine or feminine. It's not young or old. It's not hot or cold. It's not Thai food. It's not Western food. It's something that we could realize in any given moment, but we tend not to trust it. We tend to trust desire. We tend to trust our interpretations and so on. So when I suggested to you in your morning, this morning, you've had a day of meditation, to begin to trust in the stillness of knowing, I would suggest that is the gateway to the peace that the Buddha's talking about, which is a peace that isn't a function of circumstance. And by that I mean, like, let's say I'm here in the monastery, that preliminary image which you saw on your screen is our shrine, and the background are the trees. Now it's winter, the deer go by, so it's very peaceful. The circumstances are very peaceful, and that's helpful. You're in a lovely meditation center, and you have kind people around you, beautiful orchids, and such lovely things, and that's peaceful. So the circumstances are peaceful, and the Buddha suggested, yes, this is good, to create good circumstances, good environments, kalyanamitta. But those circumstances are still dependent, aren't they? They still depend on weather or people or your own health or whatever. So the peace that the Buddha is pointing to is not dependent. It's asankata. Sankata means dependently originated, and asankata, not dependent. So what is it that does not depend, which is not a quality? My sense of physical happiness, physical well-being, depends on the health of the body. My sense of social well-being depends maybe on harmony in the monastery. My sense of physical well-being, social well-being, might be dependent on whether or not we have food in the monastery. Okay, but the stillness of knowing knows qualities. It knows the feeling of insecurity. It knows the feeling of security. And that's why, if you keep referring to that, it is a gateway to true peace. because it does not depend on the emotions. It does not depend on thought. It does not depend on perceptions. It doesn't depend on bodily feelings. It knows. And if you think the way I like to consider this, I use that image a lot now, the idea of a doorway, like in your sala there, or in my sala here, there's a door. And if you're on the hallway side, then the door leads in here. And if you're in the sala side, the door leads out there. So the door participates in both spaces. Yes, it's kind of in one, not in one. It's kind of in the other, not in the other. And that's the way I like to consider the stillness of knowing, or sati sampajanya, awareness of the way things are, benyang nieng, puru, all this different language we use is, to me, pointing to the same thing. This gateway to true peace. Now that if I come into the, let's say, if I just only see one side of the gateway, and that's one side is the five khandhas, the emotions, the bodily feelings, the thoughts, the memories, the tastes and smells, all the experiences of our sense experience. And most people are just paying attention to that all the time. They're paying attention to how beautiful it is, or how difficult it is, or how ugly it is. And we have to pay attention. We have to go to work. We have to cook food. You know, we have to take care of our families. So it's a necessity. It's not that you can get out of all that, and you don't need to actually. But if that is the only way we pay attention to the objects of our sense experiences, then we're missing something. We're missing the fact of this still knowing being a doorway to the deep peace, which is behind, within, around all experience. So the idea of renunciation or non-attachment is to no longer go constantly out into sense experience, but to stay home and know sense experience as something that comes and goes, comes and goes, comes and goes, and that the still knowing does not come and go. The still knowing is unchanging. That's the perception which I hope to that you would consider. Not that you have to believe it, right? But that you consider it as a way of operating in the world, especially on a retreat. So on a retreat, most of the things are taken care of. People are kind, and you have a few duties, but not many. And now you can do the retreat, do the meditation, go to the meals, and stay in the doorway. So if the meal is satisfactory to you, stay in the doorway. Oh, this feels satisfactory. If the meal is delicious, it feels delicious. If the meal is lacking, I can't imagine the meals lacking there. The food was so amazing last year. I can't imagine lacking. But anyway, if there is something lacking, stay in the doorway. Stay in the doorway knowing this is the feeling of this is inadequate, or this is inappropriate, or if you find like a person on a retreat is irritating you for some reason, you have whatever, don't worry about the irritation. Don't follow it, but don't repress it. Stay in the doorway. No, oh, irritation feels like this. Annoyance feels like this. So all the time you're practicing still knowing with your experience, with the breath, with the walking, with eating, with taking a bath, with just sitting and looking at the clouds, or whatever you're doing. It's with the way things are. So the emphasis is not on the objective experience, beauty or ugliness, it's on the still knowing itself. And all experience indicates still knowing. You can have the most horrible meditation or the most beatific meditation, but knowing is always there. It's always there. So it's the doorway. It's the key. It's the it participates in the unconditioned, but also participates in the worldly sense experience. It's an analogy. It's not a perfect philosophical argument, but it's an analogy which I find very, very helpful. So stay in the doorway. And then you can, you know, taking a kind of intention like that, creating that as an intention of practice, then you can see what pulls you out into the room, as it were. What pulls you out? Maybe it's a, usually it's thought, isn't it? Usually it's based on memory. Maybe the memory has an emotional component. So you're sitting in a doorway of awareness, still knowing, maybe just listening to sound. And then a memory comes up of something very, very pleasant and delightful, and you start fantasizing, right? So you've got reborn, attention's gotten reborn into this fantasy, and you find yourself thinking, and then the bell rings, and the meditation is over. Well, when the bell rings and that fantasy has been interrupted, you're back home. You're back home. That's why quite often the best part of the meditation is when the bell rings. Ooh, I'm home again. Or maybe because your legs are hurting or whatever. But then in that moment, say, where the fantasy gets interrupted, take refuge in the doorway of awareness. Please don't say to yourself, oh, my meditation's not good, or try to get rid of thought. Just say, oh, no, it's like this. So you come back to the doorway all the time. And then if you do that, from the doorway, you'll notice, oh, the pattern of distraction, the pattern of going out into the world of sense experience, thought and memory, is based on some emotion, maybe. Some emotion of worry about the future. So maybe your business is affected by COVID. I'm sure that's happening a lot. Like if anyone's in the restaurant business in or entertainment in Ontario, boy, they're having a hard time. The Thai restaurants are having a hard time, although they're doing very well in takeaways also. But the Thai restaurateurs that we talk with now, because the restaurants, I don't think we can go into restaurants now, right? Yeah. So no one in Ontario, the indoor restaurants are all closed. So restaurant owners can only do takeaways. Okay. So, and we have friends in Thai restaurants in Ottawa and Kingston. So naturally, that's a cause for worry. It's a natural cause for worry. So on a retreat, if, say, a worry comes up about some business adventure or maybe some family thing, that's natural. Yeah, that's a memory. You'll have to deal with it. But can you, during this retreat, stay in the doorway and know memory, worry feels this way, rather than try to solve the problem? You'll solve the problem. You're smart enough, no problem. But can you, like, during this retreat, not try to sort out the world, not try to solve your family problems or business problems? Can you just allow them to come up as worry, as hope, as expectation, whatever it is, as an object in awareness? And this is where you see the sense of self being created. Not only will there be the functional, say, if the person is the restaurateur and they have a staff of 20 people, and now they're going to have to lay off 10 people, and they like them all. I mean, that's a very complicated problem, right? So that problem comes up as a memory, as a feeling, and then of course the sense of self gets stimulated, and the mind starts to think through a possible solution to a future problem, and you have the I making my making. And that's what I would ask you to really notice, the difference between the arising of something like a concern or worry about a business venture, and then the addition of the thinker, the doer, the sense of self. Now, it's not that you can dismiss the reality of your problem, but during this retreat, can you see this, say, in this case, this worry as a sankhara, as a phenomena, and not add to it the atavada, the ahankara, the prungdang of self, of me and mine? Can you get to it before you verbalize it? Can you get to the feeling of anxiety or worry before it becomes a whole narrative and story? Because if you can do that, we will always have worries and concerns, because this is the way that samsara is. It. Our families will have good times and bad times. So if on a retreat you can begin to be aware of the very feeling of, say, worry or anxiety, you've given yourself a huge skill that you can bring into the world, because that will happen all the time. And I'm not saying that you can't think about it, but during a retreat, you have this chance to see things before they go into narrative, into story, especially the sense of self. And then you're learning to stay in the doorway. And as you're learning to stay in the doorway, these things tend not to stay that long. They come up because of their vipaka kamma, but they don't tend to get caught in your mind. You don't get obsessed with them. So these are exercises of mindfulness. You could call it both the third or fourth foundation of mindfulness, non-attachment and cittanupassana, whatever you want to call it in Pali. But it's the very real stuff of how the sense of self gets reborn in thought, and how you can begin to see that movement as an object and find peace, the stillness of knowing within worry. That doesn't sound possible, does it? You know, worry is worry and peace is peace. But the stillness of knowing, huh, is always there, even within negative emotions and negative feelings. So if you go back to these simple suggestions that I'm making, listen to sound, stillness of knowing. Feel your breath, stillness of knowing. Worry. Now that's more challenging. But it's the same principle. Puru, no, this is worry. Now it has a bodily component, but can you not take it to thought? Can you not take it to prungdang, which is not repression? That's not getting rid of it. It's knowing it. It's knowing it. So when we talk about ploy wang, or letting go, it's that very point where the worry comes up, because that's vipaka kamma. You know, that's the result of, like in this case, I'm a restaurateur and I have a staff. Well, that's things that I've thought about and are serious in my life and I have responsibility for. So the vipaka kamma of that is maybe a worry arising. Okay, so that's nature, that's tamachat, right? But then in that point, I have this kind of Buddhist responsibility to not create a sense of self around that and yet be responsible. And this is very good on a retreat. So you think a retreat would be great if I had no worries and, you know, nothing negative happened, but would it be so great? It'd be a holiday, yeah. But if something like that comes up on a retreat, you have this chance, okay, this is a mental pattern where a strong sense of self gets created. I'm going to work with this and see how can I know the pattern but not let the sense of self get created through thought. And it's a tough exercise, but it's an exercise which pays great dividends, because that's those patterns that come up very strongly, create a strong sense of self, are the patterns which are affecting you all the time, aren't they? At home, at work, and so on. So the retreat isn't just just some kind of samatha practice where you exclude everything and you get super, super concentrated, and then you come out of the retreat and you go back to ordinary life with the same old problems, right? But I think the idea of retreat is you learn how to calm the mind, you develop the capacity to calm and compose the mind, but also you realize that we all have vipaka kamma. We have these patterns and habits, and when they come up on a retreat, it's actually a good thing. It's like an Ajahn coming. You know, I'm Ajahn Viradhammo, but you have to learn about Ajahn worry, Ajahn anxiety, Ajahn resentment, Ajahn self-disparagement, Ajahn doubt. They're all Ajahns to you, because they're the things that draw your attention out from the doorway into the sense of self getting reborn. You see what I mean? Is that sort of... it's actually quite simple, but the words make it complicated. So I have my, you know, I have the patterns I've experienced, and you have your patterns. So my patterns were around fear, social anxiety, self-doubt, but also mind states of contempt and arrogance. All of that has been a part of my vipaka experience, right? And then I you know, initially I thought, well, if I don't have this, if I don't have that, if I get rid of that, then I will have peace. But then that's becoming, and that was based on tanha. I am someone who's inadequate. I have contemptuous states of mind, and I have worried states of mind, and it's I, me, 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 me. And then slowly through the teaching, no, it's not me. It's dependently originated. It's vipaka kamma. Okay. And then I began to be more objective. I could see, say, contemptuous states of mind or worried states of mind as objects in awareness. And once I had that down, then I could start to liberate those tendencies, that vipaka kamma, from the heart. I'm very slow. This takes me a long time. I don't know about you. I don't find it easy, but I find it very interesting. You know, I find vipaka kamma very, very interesting, how these things have been conditioned into my mind over many, many years, through society, through family, and they still have, you know, power sometimes to arise. So this is why metta bhavana, you know, the way metta bhavana tends to sometimes, I don't know about in Thailand, but it sometimes tends to be taught as prayer. So I send metta to you, right? So it's like it's actually very Christian in some sense. I pray for your good health, and you pray for my good health. Okay, that's nice. I certainly don't pray for your bad health. but I don't think, you know, I think the deeper implication of metta bhavana, I don't find that way of teaching metta bhavana in the texts. I don't know, again, Thai culture, if that's the way it works, but certainly Western culture, they say, can you send me some metta? Well, I said, well, why don't you go to Amazon? They can send you some metta. But I think what metta bhavana is, it's a particular state of mind. It's a particular attitude, which is not about sending something out, but it's a particular attitude that is really a part of right awareness, I would say. Because samasati must be the capacity to accept all things and reject none. Because anything that comes into conscious experience is natural, even if it's horrible. Even if I have a contemptuous feeling or a resentful feeling or a loving feeling or a blissful feeling, they're all tamachat. So I might think that the beatific feeling is more right than a contemptuous feeling, but they're both right in the sense that they arose. They're neither right nor wrong, they're dependently originated. Yeah. So metta bhavana for me is an attitude of mind which creates an awareness which is very open, not critical, not judgmental. Panya can be critical and judgmental. Panya can say, don't go that way, Viradhammo. Don't think that way. That's not helpful. That's unskillful. Don't do that. Don't speak like that. You know, that can be the critical faculty. But before the critical faculty can be employed and used correctly, I think there has to be metta. The mind first and foremost has to accept that there is this feeling or this sensitivity. Because if there isn't first and foremost an acceptance of the way things are, then there tends to be a reactivity to the negative, trying to get rid of it, and a reactivity to the positive and trying to get the positive. But first and foremost, we have to see that all things which arise are natural because they arose. They may not be good, they may not be wholesome. We don't want to have to follow the negative ones, but they are natural. So for me, metta bhavana is that capacity to first and foremost open that life is like this. So when Lompa says to me, it's like this, to me that includes metta, because I have to accept it. I have to accept it. And if I am open and accept the negativity, then I can work with it. Because now I know it fully as Dharma rather than as self. As self, I could say, I shouldn't be like that. I should be some other way. And that's no longer awareness. Awareness does not know. Ego knows now. I don't want this and I want something else. So the way I practice is what I'm doing with metta bhavana is I'm opening the heart by remembering people I love, by recollecting people I respect and have gratitude towards, and then I'm remembering the feeling of openness. I'm remembering, recollecting the feeling of metta. And then I can let go of the people, and then I can allow that feeling of openness to be part of my awareness practice. And as it's a part of my awareness practice, if something comes up which I don't like, the feeling of metta changes to a contraction, and I can notice that, and I can go back to openness. And then I can allow, like this negative vipaka that we experience, I can allow it to be in consciousness, because now there is respect for it as a condition, but there isn't attachment to it as a self. And then it begins to purify. So for me, awareness and metta are very, very close. It seems to me that they're a pair which are a necessary pair. So there's, you know, this idea of panya, understanding, but metta, accepting. So for me, panya is that which directs and encourages the wholesome and discourages the unwholesome. It's the language I would use. But metta is the establishing of what's actually going on, what's open. Now you can see that's different than sending metta to someone. Huh? That to me seems very dualistic. I'm here, you're there, I send you metta, which is lovely to do. I mean, I do it. And I sit in my room and I go through all the members of our community. May you be well, may you be well, may you be well, may you be well, right? But I don't ask him in the morning, did it hit you? Did I nail you with my metta? Oh, yes. It's not like that. So these are just verbal strategies we use. But to me, what's important is that we understand that awareness and metta, when they're conjoined, they are part of samasati, I would say. You know, at least that's my experience, samasati. So during the retreat, whatever way you do metta bhavana, do it a lot. Like, not as a kind of technique that you have to do. Now I'm going to do an hour of metta, and now I'm going to do an hour of anapanasati. And, you know, that's too technical. I mean, I'm not that so technical guy. But do metta bhavana as a way of remembering what it feels like to be open. Now, one of the misuses of metta bhavana is to actually get rid of things, isn't it? So you have a negative feeling, so you do metta bhavana to get rid of the negative feeling. How could that work? That could never work, because it's based upon getting rid of, it's dosa. So the irony is sometimes people use metta with the underlying intention of dosa. Weird. So you feel, you know, you feel like you don't like your neighbor. Your neighbor's very noisy, they play loud music, and you want to meditate, right? And you're starting to feel annoyed. Their kids are playing rock music or rap or whatever, and you're trying to meditate, and then you're starting to hate them. Yeah? Those stupid neighbors, I hate them, I hate them. And then you feel guilty. I shouldn't hate them. And then you start to do metta bhavana. May they be well, I hate them. I hate them. And you get very, very confused. But that's not metta bhavana. That's just trying to get rid of your anger, right? And I think we've all done that. We've all done that, right? So metta bhavana would be opening your heart to the feeling of aversion, right? And that's different. That's more difficult. So the feeling of aversion arises. So you have, first of all, I want to be peaceful, and peaceful is a circumstance. Peaceful is a quiet room with no noise. And then noise comes, circumstance changes, desire arises, desire goes into aversion, I hate the neighbors. Then there's a desire not to have the aversion, Then you do the metta bhavana, and it's a mess. It's a total mess, right? So first and foremost, you have to say it's like this. Like the sound is like this. Go back to that. And you recognize, oh, this is what it feels like to want to murder the neighbors or to move to Canada or whatever you want. And you start to get really good at recognizing what is actually going on. What's going on now is dislike of sound. Okay, you're now, so sati and metta are together now because you're accepting it. Then you can start to practice because you know what's going on. You can practice, you know, like bodily awareness because your body's getting tense. Or you can just listen to sound and see where is the tanha in that sound. You can use sound as your object of awareness. But now you're not trying to get rid of it. You're trying to understand your relationship to this sound. And like Lompa Cha would say, he said, you know, you think that sound is bothering you. Stop going out there and bothering the sound. It's brilliant, isn't it? It's brilliant. But first of all, you have to kind of get in the game. And the game is sati. And the doorway then, the doorway of awareness has this sense of being open. You know, it's open to both. It's open to both. It's not a closed thing that you have to open. It's open. And standing in that door is sati and metta. You know, they are together that way. So please do contemplate. How do you perceive metta bhavana? Is it like a list you do where you cover everyone? If you've got a big family, it takes a long time. and like you have to cover, give everyone 5 minutes or you feel that they've been cheated. Is that what you do? Or is it simply recollection of someone that you respect and love and have gratitude towards, which then brings your heart to that feeling? Then you don't need the people anymore because your heart's there. And then how can you sustain that and recollect that in daily life? I think you remember that story I told, I think I told this last time, but I was doing a retreat in New Zealand. And two of the elderly retreatants, I asked them both, how's the metta bhavana going? One, she said, oh, it's such hard work. You know, I can never get through the whole family in 1 hour. I said, I'm so tired. I said, no. The other one, what's interesting, it was during the bombing of Belgrade in the Serbian war, which was one in the 90s. And she was crying. I said, why are you crying? She said, well, I'm trying to send metta to all the people in Belgrade. And I just keep seeing them getting bombed and killed. And it's horrible. That's not metta bhavana. It was some sense of karuna confused with, I should be able to heal them. I can't heal them. Very, very confused. And she was crying. A very good woman, right? And so she didn't really understand that metta bhavana is not ascending or a healing or that. It's an abiding in a wholesome mind state, which then serves sati, serves mindfulness, and serves your life. And then from that, you can always help people and be with people. So I'm not saying you shouldn't send metta, but see it as a verbal strategy for just, and if you have a big family, don't worry about it. Do it in shifts. Okay, so that's a lot of ideas to process. Maybe I'll stop there with those ideas. Yeah, maybe I'll just finish the talk there. Now, this session, does it have a question, a Q&A in it, Yongpeng? Or what's the plan? Oh, I can't hear you. Fang Mai Ok.
Then you may ka. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Okay, ka. Actually, it should be Q&A session, but I'm not sure if there are questions coming in.
Okay, so the question was, is accepting the way things are similar to upeka? That's a good question I could maybe work on, okay? So what does privately mean on a chat?
It's just to us.
Oh, it's just to us, I see, right? So the question was, is like accepting the way things are similar to upekkha? And as you all know, the teaching of the Brahma Viharas has a kind of fourfold explanation. And to me, they are all really part of the heart. And so you have metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha. To me, they're not really separate. It seems to me that metta is, first of all, in its most simple articulation, is the capacity to not hate. It's simplest. So I can be irritated at someone, but I can also not go to hatred. I can feel upset with someone, but I can not hate them. I can not wish them ill will. That's to me the kind of lowest entry point for metta. To say that I can love all people, may all beings be well and happy, I can say that, but to love people all the time, to me seems, I don't know, that seems a bit not human. Not realistic, at least, not realistic. Maybe someone can do that. But so if you say metta bhavana is loving everyone all the time, what are you going to do with aversion? Right? What are you going to do with annoyance? Then you feel guilty. Oh, I'm a bad Buddhist. I honked at someone in the traffic jam. But if you see metta bhavana as simply not dwelling in wishing someone ill will. You can dislike someone, and that's natural. Someone is obnoxious or difficult or cheating. It's pretty hard to like them, and to ask you to like them, you're not going to like them. But you can, as your mind's going to thinking ill will, you know, may they have a car accident, may they go bankrupt, may they get arthritis, you know. You cannot do that. You can not wish them ill will. And that is possible, isn't it? Right? There's a difference between anger and hatred. Anger just flares up. I don't think it's a big problem. Hatred is a deep problem. Contempt is a deep problem. So like in the political election we've just had south of the border, the hatred that is exhibited between these different groups of political people and political parties and is very destructive to society. Which is different than getting angry at someone and having a disagreement. That's just sort of the flare of emotion. So metta bhavana is first and foremost protecting us from that movement towards hatred. Now, as you develop metta bhavana and you open up to the difficulty of being a human being and the challenges of childhood conditioning, whatever it is, you begin to see, well, people have problems because of conditions. So if you have someone who's very cruel and then you find out that their parents were abusive, you begin to see, wow, he's really suffering. He's an abusive person. Yeah, I protect myself from him, but I can understand where his abusive behavior is coming from because his parents are abusive. So you start to have a grander feeling for this being. You still protect yourself, right? So metta bhavana starts to come into a more a mature phase that all beings are subject to vibhaka kamma. They're subject to all kinds of conditioning and they suffer. So metta bhavana becomes much more forgiving. But it's not an attitude just to suppress any angers and fears you have. So in your own angers and fears that you have, metta bhavana would be, oh yeah, that's the conditioning from childhood. Or that's the result of actually being cheated by someone. So if someone, you know, if someone's been through a really horrible divorce and the partner's cheated on them and they didn't know, and then the cheating's been going on for 5 years and then they find out and then all of a sudden their whole psychology is confused and all kinds of emotions come up. And they feel angry at the person. That's not their fault. It's just kamma, vipaka kamma, right? And that might last for a few years, resentments, and be patient. Okay, this is vipaka kamma, rather than thinking, I shouldn't feel this. So metta bhavana matures into a grander and grander acceptance of all the negativity of things. And you can see then that begins to be what upeka is about. Upeka is the capacity to accept all the formations that come to us. And in a human emotional sense, that acceptance is both compassionate and peaceful. With compassion and peace. It's not indifferent. If we think that upeka, equanimity, is indifference, then it doesn't have metta in it. It doesn't have the sense of, oh yeah, this person, yeah, they got abused by their father and now they have abusive tendencies. Oh gosh, what a difficult karma they're having, right? And then there's a sense of acceptance of them. Socially, you could still say you can't abuse, you can't do that. That's wrong. I don't care what your childhood is about. You can't do that. That's illegal. That's immoral. You can't do that. So as a social being, you call them. You say that. But that doesn't mean you hate them. You try to have. But if they're too toxic, you don't have to relate with them because it's too difficult. So it's not even saying that. So metta has, you know, it's not like just one thing. It's a kind of development the heart becomes more grand and more large in understanding life. It's a part of maturity too, I think. So then karuna, yes, karuna is of course compassion. And that's the and you can see how metta goes into karuna too. And that's the feeling of empathy for the suffering of others. And most of us are very, very, very good on feeling empathy, but where we fail in that is we think sometimes that we have to cure another person's problem. That's, for me, as a teacher come counselor sometimes, that was my early problem with karuna, is a person would come to me with a problem, impossible social problem, and with it, all the emotional baggage that problem was presenting, I'd listen to them. And then I would inadvertently think, I have to solve their problem. It wasn't conscious. It was more like, this is my responsibility. And that was exhausting. But that's not karuna. Karuna is empathy, but it's not saying you have to solve the problem, because you can't. Everyone has their own predicament. So to have empathy, but then not to walk away with the worry, I have to fix this. So if you have that, if your empathy, especially, this must be especially true in family. You know, if you have a grandchild, like I have a friend whose grandchild is having a lot of problems because of certain family things, and it's torture for her because she can't fix it. You know, and she sees where it's going. It's not going in a good direction. And that's where karuna needs upeka. You know, she has to somehow say, yeah, life is this way. I don't have control. This is bigger than me. But the karuna, it's hard to get the upeka in. It's hard to accept this very, very real difficulty that she has, because she loves the child so much. And she was a very good mother, so she can't understand how all this is happening. Well, she can, I suppose, but yeah, it's a difficult one. So upeka is saying, yeah, this hurts, and life is this way. So you have to be with the hurt, and then be patient, and then you tend to somehow resolve it. Family things are very, 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 very difficult that way. Mudita is. Have you ever thought why we can appreciate beauty? We can't we? Now, some people say, oh, it's because of greed. You know, if food didn't taste good, you wouldn't eat it and you'd starve to death. So that's a kind of, to me, very simplistic. Yeah, there's pleasant and there's unpleasant, right? You eat the food, and because it tastes pleasant, you eat the food, you have nutrition, da, 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 da. But isn't there more to our experience? What is beauty about? I've thought about this a lot the last few years. Why is it that we can see beauty and not want to own it? Like the deer here, they're so cute. they're They were under my bird feeder just over here. And you know, deer have articulated ears. So they're looking at you, huh? But their ears are going back and listening, and they're going forward and going around. And you watch this guy, and he's beautiful. He's actually beautiful. I don't want to eat him. In fact, the hunters were just hunting. The hunting season just ended. The hunters want to eat him. I don't want to eat her or him. I just appreciate the beauty. Now, what is that in our minds? Is that selfish? Am I attached to sense experience? Do I need the deer to be happy? or is it something which is actually maybe part of the Brahma Viharas? And I would suggest that that is what mudita is about. That usually in the Brahma Viharas, mudita is phrased as appreciation for the goodness of others. So it's usually related on a human sense. And so if you're a grandmother, or you're a mother and your child or your grandchild is beautiful and successful, you're really happy. You have a lot of mudita for the person, don't you? Someone you respect. But of course, if it's your grandchild and the grandchild's having problems, you worry. Huh? So there's attachment there. But I'm not like when I look at in the autumn here, these trees, which you cannot see now, you'll see later, the colors are exquisite. The yellows and reds and browns when the western light shines on them, it's just exquisite. I can just sit there and enjoy. Now, I don't need that joy. You know, now it's all kind of gray and there's no leaves. I'm not attached to that. But is there not something very healthy about beauty without attaching to it? So the beauty of commerce is the beauty which gets you to consume. So the beauty of an iPad is to get you to buy an iPad. Or the beauty of a dress, or the beauty of jewelry, or the beauty of these things. Consumerism knows how to do beauty, but the beauty which stimulates greed, right? But when I look at a maple tree and it's in full color, I don't want to own it. I don't want to chop it down and make it furniture. Maybe I do. I appreciate it. Now I can't appreciate that if I'm just thinking all the time. If I'm worrying and I'm angry at one of the monks, or I'm daydreaming or whatever, I don't even see the tree. It's there, but I don't see it. So I think that mudita is a way of both bringing joy to the heart and also bringing presence, to notice the orchid, to look at the color of the orchid. To allow that color to come to you requires attention and presence. And because it has a certain form and color, you can abide very easily with beauty. But the beauty is not about the object. It's about awareness itself. And so consumerism is about the object. We'll make something beautiful, you'll buy it. Where the beauty of the spiritual life brings you back to the stillness of knowing. Try that with a tree. You just sit and look at a tree and let the tree come to you. And because the shape of the tree is neutral or beautiful, whatever, it doesn't pull you, you know, really strong. Let the tree come to you and abide in that doorway of stillness of awareness. Very interesting nature that way. And that's really helpful because so much of our meditation is like trying and doing and you know, techniques and becoming enlightened. And oh my gosh. but this isn't this whole project of doing, it's just being. You sit on a bench, look at a tree, and people might think you're lazy. Well, they're not meditating, they're not doing walking, but that's their problem. Try that where there isn't a sense of like meditation always being this hard work, where meditation is the sense of relaxing and being with the tree, being with that. And if they chop the tree down, okay, that's what it feels like to have a chopped tree down. Not nice, but in the meantime. So I think mudita has, for me, a broader sense than just people. I think it's that whole aspect of consciousness which is enjoyed, and it's an allowable happiness. You know, it's not the happiness of attachment and greed and those kinds of things. So, you know, I always put these sort of rhetorical questions to people. what is, you know, why as human beings can we notice beauty? And it doesn't have to have a philosophical answer, but it is something a part of our life, isn't it? And what is it about like an old person who physically doesn't look that beautiful, but they're beautiful. You know, like my mother was very beautiful, but at 96, she didn't look like whoever, right? She was old, she was withered, her body was. Can I tell you a funny story? When in the last year of her life, so mom was, she had osteoporosis. She was legally blind with macular degeneration. She had lost 4 inches of height from the osteoporosis, so her back was slightly stooped over. And she was like maybe 5 foot tall. I think 4'11", she didn't like that. she had lost a bit of height, okay. And in the last few years of her life, I had two friends who were physiotherapists. And they would come and help mom. And one day they were in the washroom with mom helping her wash. And my mom wore this green fleece bathrobe, full length. She really loved it. It was nice and warm. She would get around on a walker like that. So I found this story actually when we had mom's funeral. I didn't even know the story. One of the physiotherapists told the story. So there they are, they're in the washroom. These two younger women are helping mom, and she's got her bathrobe on, but she has nothing on underneath. And so she says, just before she opens her bathrobe to get a bath, she says, "Witness Venus de Milo," and opens up the bathrobe. You know, Venus de Milo is one of the most beautiful, iconic paintings in Western art. And she did not look like Venus de Milo, but she had this lovely sense of humor. So she was beautiful, wasn't she? And that's mudita, isn't it? That's mudita where you know, we see something which lifts our hearts. And if we don't have that in our meditation practice, it's just too hard. It is working all the time to get your enlightenment or to get your samadhi or, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's horrible. So certainly we cultivate samadhi, but there is beauty in people, in situations, and in that. And to have the openness and awareness to actually appreciate, to notice, is a very good thing for the heart that carries you. Now, all of life, a lot of life is actually pretty ugly. Right? It's, you know, you see people who are actually quite ugly in their behavior. They don't bring that forth, right? But there's the other too. So these four, metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha, I often talk about them, and they're very rich for cultivation and for contemplation. They're not just one thing. And I think, to me, you know, the liberation of the heart from a Buddhist sense is that. You know, what is the definition of someone that's enlightened, usually like an arahant? We kind of talk about like someone who doesn't have feelings or emotions. Well, Ajahn Chah was so alive, you know, we're so alive with love and compassion and humor and all of that. And what is the life of enlightenment? I think it's the Brahmaviharas. It seems to me that's what it would be. They're very wholesome, very beautiful. Rather than enlightened being some kind of quiet zone where nothing's happening. That's, I think, annihilation. So as human beings, as long as we are incarnate in these bodies, we are emotional beings, but they don't have to be negative emotions. They can be wholesome mind states. Now, in Theravada Buddhism, usually don't talk about emotions. It's just talk about states of mind, don't we? In Western culture, you have the word emotion, but usually it's just types of citta. So these are types of citta, which create a foundation where you can stay in the doorway of awareness, because mudita is a way of really staying home and being with the way things are. Whereas greed takes you out of the doorway. I want to own that. I want to have that. I want to keep that. All right. Is there any other? Let's see if there's any more. Kindly touch upon citing Buddha together with breathing and breathing out. So the question is, if I would comment on using the word Buddha together with breathing in and breathing out. Okay. So mantras or repeated words are ways of, so this is taught a lot in Thailand, isn't it? Buddha, or maybe like Bu on the in-breath, Do on the out-breath. Or if your mind's very busy, Buddha, 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 you know, a lot. So there's different ways this is taught. And that's, of course, to help ground yourself in the present moment and help you to not engage the thinking mind. So you take thought, the word Buddha is a thought, it's an idea, or is words, and you take one word to replace the millions of words which keep obsessing your mind. Now, you have to use it mindfully rather than repressively. So if you think you're going to get rid of thought by saying Buddha, you might for a while, Buddha, 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 and then all of a sudden you'll be lost in thinking. But I think the correct way of doing that is when you notice you're thinking, then notice, oh, thought is there. This is what thought is. And then you present another thought, Buddha, Buddha. You present it into the mind mindfully rather than repressively. You're not trying to get rid of thought. You're replacing thought now quite carefully, quite mindfully, and you can join it with the breath. Bu, do. And then you get lost. And then you're thinking about work. And then you're thinking about your parents or whatever. And then something happens. And then you mindfully register, it's like this now. That's the most important thing. I'm feeling this now. And I'm worrying a lot. Oh, there's a lot of worry. Okay, you know the pattern. And then you go back. Bu, do. So you're composing the mind and collecting the mind. So it depends, all of these techniques depend on the skill of awakening and the skill of picking up the object and sustaining the object. But it's not about the object, it's not about repression. So if I'm using Buddha for the stillness of knowing, Buddha, I know what's going on, I know I'm saying it. I know the end of the breath, I know the in-breath, but I'm emphasizing the still knowing. If I'm just trying to hold back thought, repress thought, get rid of thought. Okay, Buddha, Buddha, Buddha. Then there's tension. Huh? Whereas this has an openness and has an awareness that, yeah, now there are going to be a lot of thoughts of worry because that's what the pattern is now. That'll come up again, okay. And I'll just go back to Buddha. So you make a deal with yourself. You know, as the thoughts, in this case, the restaurateur worrying about the restaurant business, okay. For this hour, I'm not going to go to worry. I'm going to go to Buddha. It's a deal you make. Huh? It's an agreement you make. But it's not saying that I will never think about the restaurant. No, that will come up. But for this hour, no, thank you. Let's just do Buddha. So it's a patient returning to a word to replace all those other words. And I think Lompa Samedo, if I remember correctly, when he came to Thailand, 47 years ago, maybe 46 years ago, he said his mind thought so much that he would just do Buddha, 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 Buddha constantly, or let go, let go, let go, let go, let go. He just filled it with a word because he couldn't get any space around the mind. Now he hardly thinks at all. But that's very cool. That's very nice. It's very, very silent. Huh? So it kind of depends where you're at. But be careful not to use these techniques to get rid of anything and become something. That's where it will fail. It won't work. Where it will work, if you understand, stand in the doorway and what are the techniques would help you to stay in the doorway? Metta bhavana, anapanasati, whatever. To me, that's first principle. One more. See, so you got some more. Brother, sister, will the talk be recorded? Okay. With the mind at the door, do we need to question why certain mental states are out? Okay, so another question. With the mind at the door, do we need to question why certain mental states arise? And I would say generally no. Generally what happens is we don't have faith in awareness, we have faith in thought. So the mind then starts to analyze, why am I thinking so much? I should have got beyond that now. And the mind just creates more thought. So basically you want to learn how to move away from thought. And this isn't absolute, you know. There might be something which you really need to analyze and look at. But for the most part, I think 90% of the time, it's just habit. It's just a habit of your personality that's been created. And if you take it like that, then you begin to be interested in no thought. That isn't the same as no feeling. No thought is just not adding thought to the feelings that are there. And then it becomes a more, I think, from Lompo Sumedho's suggestion, it becomes more an act of faith and wisdom. The faith of Sada is in knowing. Benyang Nieng. It's like this. That's the faith, that you trust that rather than trusting in the thinking analytical mind. Again, this isn't absolute. I'm not saying you can't do that. But my own experience talking to people who meditate, that tends to, analysis tends to be overemphasized, and no thought tends to be not understood or not done or not entered into. I suggest that's a more difficult thing. But that's not getting rid of thought. It's just abiding in pure awareness of the way things are. So if thought formations are coming up, what is most useful? See, what type of jitta is this? Is this a worry jitta or an annoyed jitta or fantasizing? And just kind of, you know, the labeling technique that I think the Mahasi tradition uses, that can be very, very helpful, because you're identifying like an energy pattern which is now coming as a vipaka into the present moment. Yeah, and having identified with it, you'll know it'll come up again in thought. And your task is to stay in the dory, not go into the thinking process. Whereas if you analyze, you just go back into thinking. Again, not an absolute, but I think on the whole, don't go there. You don't need to analyze. You've probably analyzed it to death already. So you've probably done enough of that. One more, my side too missed. I say missed many parts. Oh, so that was the, yeah. My apologies to some people who are not picking up the audio. It's coming and going. Might be your router, might be my router, might be life.